This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 227. I was actually talking to a buddy this week who did not know that I did a podcast. And every time I kind of explain the fact that I'm doing this podcast, it gets harder and harder to justify why am I doing this podcast. And really, the best answer I have this at this point is I do this podcast because I don't know when to quit. So I just keep doing it. I'm thinking, you know, maybe someday the grandkids will listen. Maybe someday the great-grandkids will listen. So there is a little old lady that is styling. She has got her thigh mid-calf pants on, and she's got her floppy hat on, and she is hunkered back and got her purse slung around. I hope I'm styling that good when I'm that age. She looks like she's going places. Anyways, that was on the street as I was passing. Never mind, that's a sidebar. I am getting started home a little late today. That's because I'm having a little adventure with the state government. I titled a trailer that my buddy, my best friend, who I bought out his share of the property, and one of the things came along with that was a trailer, so we bought this trailer in like 1983, and we paid like $475 for it. We bought it new, we thought we bought it new. So we buy this trailer, and he goes ahead and just puts the title in his name just to make it easier, which is fine with me. And we're paying the property tax for it out of the partnership monies, and, you know, we're just taking care of it that way. Everything's great. So things go on. I buy him out, you know, so I get the trailer. So he gives me the title on the trailer, and he just signs it over to me as a gift. Fine and dandy. I take it down. I get a license on it. It's a gift. Ta-da! Then I get this letter from the state government, and the state government says, you can't title that as a gift because it's already been gifted once. Really? So I, you know, so that chews into a little bit of my time after I leave work. So then I come back and call my buddy. Yep, we bought that new. Well, I thought we bought that new. Yeah, we bought that new. So now I have to call the state government tomorrow. I really was willing just to give them money to get this thing closed. But I took it down to my local office, and one of the things I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to tell them what the fair market value is. And so I just looked at her and I said, so how about if I just put $200 in there? And she said, no, you got to look it up on the internet and you go... Okay. And she said, so I have to have documentation. Yep, you're going to have documentation, and you're going to have to send it to Jeff City. Okay. So I couldn't just tell you $200 or $400 or $800 and just pay the 6% tax and do it and close it. Nope. Okay. So there you go. So now I'm going to call Jeff City. I'll find out what they want, and we'll go from there. But hey, it's a great country. It's a great life. I am happy to live in this country. I suppose the other option is I just don't title the trailer and I don't drive it around, which that may be a bigger option than I think, because the tires are actually rotted out on that trailer, and it's quite possible it will never be driven again. But we'll see. Anyways, I think I mentioned last week that I am theoretically within 2 weeks of being done. And in fact, that was last week. This week, I'm almost at 47,000 words. And this book is only supposed to go to 5,000, which would mean I am... theoretically going to be done this week, but I don't think I am. Because the way it's going, I think I'm going to need to get to 55, if not 60,000, to get everything wrapped up. Because I have more story to tell. So I'm kind of waiting to see how that goes. It's interesting. I still have a few pieces to resolve. There is this thing in storytelling, and I wish I knew what the actual pronunciation was, but there is a thing called Deus Ex Machina. And if I've got my definitions correctly, it basically means God in the machine. And it is a pejorative term when it comes to story writing, because it is supposedly an ending where everything looks dire and bleak, and then, ta-da, you know, something happens where God intervenes or something, and then everything's good. And there are some aspects of what I'm doing that, at the end of this book, that could be considered Deus Ex Machina. And so I'm trying to blunt those a little bit. One of the things that I don't like about the season finale of Series 6 of Doctor Who, and if you all haven't watched Doctor Who and you're planning on watching Doctor Who at some point, the reboot, the modern series, you better just fast forward. Because the end of Series 6, I'm about to give away the whole... Spoiler alert. I'm about to give away the whole plot thing at the end of Series 6, and you really don't want to hear this if you're ever planning on. So I'm just going to give you a moment, and you can just go forward 30 seconds. Okay, so I got 20 seconds to go. In the end of Series 6, what happens is it's literally God in a machine. It literally is that. That's how the Doctor escapes and doesn't die, yada yada. And it was just very sour in my mouth when I watched it. So that's why I don't really like that. Anyway, so you're back if you skipped ahead. And so I'm kind of wrestling with that a little bit still. But I think I got enough pieces that I can make this work. It's interesting, I was out to talk with a buddy on Tuesday, and we were talking about the writing process, and I really felt like I should tell him about this struggle and how that I have this little clock that is supposedly going to communicate in some way with my heroine, and that I need to get really clever for how a clock with two hands and a face but no mouth and no eyes could communicate. I had the clock communicating with her in book one, and it would be a nice bookend if I did that in book three. And I told him I have no idea how I'm going to do that, and I wanted to do something clever, and I'm just waiting for Jesus to help me through that little thing. As it turns out, now I may not need that, so I would have to go back to him and say, yeah, that didn't work out, which I would really like to make it work out, but who knows? I have a day of writing tomorrow, and a day of writing on Saturday, and a day to write on Sunday. I love weekends. Love weekends. Because I can write. Love weekends. Anyways, I was last night looking around for things I wanted to talk about, and I had bookmarked an article, I think this was in the New York Times, by Frank Bruni, and it was titled, Sexism's Puzzling Stamina. And in this article, the author was in essence saying, I'm really surprised we aren't farther along than we are at this point when it comes to the relationships between men and women. Now, personally, I'm not surprised at all. But that's because I have a framework that predicts that this tension between men and women will never be resolved. But anyways, let's look at what he has to say, and then I'll chat a little bit at the end. He said in this article, just what I said, he said, I thought somehow we'd be farther along by now. He said he can't get past the widely noted image from a week ago of the Senate hearing into an internal panel, the epidemic of sexual assault in the military. It showed an internal panel of witnesses, there was 11 men, one woman. It showed the backs of some of the senators who were listening to them, five men and one woman from a Senate committee encompassing 19 men and seven women in all. Under discussion was the violation of women and how to stop it, and men, once more, were getting more say. Said he kept flashing back to Tailhook. For those of you who are younger, Tailhook happened in 1991. I remember Tailhook. It was the year in which some 100 Navy and Marine aviators were accused of sexually assaulting scores of women. But it was also the year of Susan Faludi's runaway bestseller Backlash on the War Against American Women, as the subtitle said. You know, that sounds like a very interesting book. I may have to pull that up and see if I can get that on my Kindle and read it. It was when the issue of sexual harassment took center stage in Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings. I remember that as well. In 1991, I would have been 38, I think. Is that right? I was born in 58. So, no. So I'd been 33, something like that. Anyways, he said, so now here we are, 32 years later, and we're listening to Saxe Chambliss, the senator from Georgia, attributing sexual abuse in the military to the ineluctable hormone level of virile young men in proximity to nubile young women. He said, the author of the article said, we're also congratulating ourselves on the historic high of 20 women in the Senate, even though there are still 4 men to every one of them, and among governors, 9 men to every woman. And he doesn't talk about the boardroom because he said Sheryl Sandberg's book tour covered that. He said, what about movies? And he went through, he said, you know, there was a time when we had a lot of heroines and things. He said, but last summer, you got Kristen Stewart, Snow White, and she has to have a huntsman at her side. And he said, and this summer, there's Iron Man, Man of Steel, Will Smith, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Channing Tatum, all shouldering the weight of civilization's future, and he sees no comparable crew of warrior goddesses. Okay, all right. He said that heroines fare better on TV, but even there, he is struck by the persistent stereotype of a woman whose career devotion is both seed and flower of a tortured private life, and he named off. And he said when a recent Pew Center report came out showing that women had become primary providers in 40% of the households with at least one child under 18, it prompted conservative commentators Lou Dobbs and Eric Eckerson to fret. They fretted, respectively, over the disillusion of society and the endangerment of children. And when Megyn Kelly challenged them on Fox News, they responded in a patronizing manner that they'd never use with a male co-anchor. Okay. He goes through sports, too. I guess we're on the third attempt to get a viable soccer league going for women. Of course, the National Women's National Basketball Association is way behind the NBA in terms of visibility and revenue. And he said, you know, when you look at literature, male authors take the lion's share of prominent reviews as the annual Vita survey documents. Now, of course, J.K. Rowling kind of offsets some of that because, obviously, she wrote books that, you know, sold over $1 billion. But anyways, reflecting on that, this is an interesting quote. Reflecting on that last week, critic Laura Miller accurately noted, and this is important, there's a grandiose self-presentation, a swagger, that goes along with advancing your book as a great American novel that many women find impossible or silly. Okay. So then, in concluding his article, he makes the point that racial bigotry has often been tied to ignorance abetted by unfamiliarity, that homophobia is a failure to realize how many gay people we know and respect. He said, well, women are in the next cubicle across the dinner table, and on the other side of the bed, almost every man has a mother he has known and probably cared about. Most have a wife, daughter, sister, aunt, niece as well. Our stubborn sexism harms and holds them back. Not strangers. Still, it survives. Okay. Do I dispute that sexism exists? No, I do not. I absolutely do not. I see it everywhere. And it's not hard to spot. Well, I was going to give an example, but she may listen to this podcast someday. It's highly unlikely, so I'm not going to use that example. But I'm just going to go on with my little explanation why I think we will never escape sexism. And frankly, it's going to be a long time before we get away. We will get away from racism and homophobia far quicker than we will ever get away from sexism. And the reason is that the flesh has such a powerful, powerful tool to use against us when it comes to sexism. And it really just comes down to the basic lies that the flesh tells men versus the basic lie that the flesh tells women. And the reason that the flesh is successful in this lie is that there is a true biological component to it. We are built differently. I'm not saying that justifies sexism, because it does not. Because sexism at its core, whether it's sexism from a man's viewpoint or whether it's sexism from a woman's viewpoint, and I'll talk about that in a minute, sexism at its core objectifies and reduces the value of its target. And by reducing the value of its target, it can then justify the way it treats the target. At its core, sexism is based on some fundamental drives that differ on average. Not saying every woman and every man have to have these drives, but that differ on average between men and women. The quick three or four word explanation is that men hunt, women nest. Fundamentally, men conquer, women seek to nurture. Fundamentally. Fundamentally, men are looking to have sex and women are looking for security. That's not to say that women don't enjoy having sex. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that it's a much stronger drive in a man than it is in a woman, fundamentally. Now, that's all just natural. There's no reason that that needs to lead to sexism. What grows out of that is the bargaining that typically takes place in a male-female relationship. The old saying is that men trade security to get sex, and women trade sex to get security. And once they have security, sometimes what turns upside down, I'm getting my mail, what turns upside down on that is that the flesh can then turn around and say, well, if you're servicing him all the time and you're just doing that, then obviously you're no better than a prostitute, you know, and so he should just appreciate you for your mind and who you are. And okay, first of all, yes, that there is a truth to that. But it is quite often a upsetting and bewildering revelation for men that prior to the marriage, they thought there would be a certain sexual temperature in the marriage because there seemed to be a lot of interest on it prior to the marriage. And then once they do get married, I'm backing into my garage one moment, that cools, and it cools fairly rapidly if you don't understand what's going on. So none of that, however, justifies sexism. Where sexism comes from is it comes from the fact that the flesh is able to take those foundational pieces. I still haven't gotten my air conditioning fixed. The flesh is able to take those foundational pieces and it's able to build a layer on top of them by twisting those foundational pieces and making them more than they are. And the lie that, and I've said this before, so if you've heard it before, sorry, I'm going to repeat myself. The lie that the flesh in general tells men is that women exist as a tool to help them control their sperm count. And the lie that the flesh tells women is that men exist to provide them security and safety so that they can raise a family. And this is bad both ways. You know, one of the interesting places this comes down that I've made note of is in the idea of taking out the garbage. Because you talk to men, quite a few men, and they'll say, you know, I don't really see why that's got to be a guy's job. Well, it goes outside the home. It's happening out there. Got to take out the garbage. That just seems, for some women, it's a little beneath them to take out the garbage. You know, don't want to get their hands dirty. Around my house, I take out the garbage. That's fine. I just take it out. We're done. But there's an interesting, it's really interesting when you really listen to couples, this issue. It's a foregone conclusion for many, many women that the guy is supposed to take out the garbage. Well, see, that is a form of sexism in my book. That what you're really doing is you're saying, you're an object that exists to do what I tell you to do, and anything that I don't want to do, you're just supposed to pick that up and do that. And so men are sexist when they believe that women only exist as tools to help them manage their sperm count and when they treat women like tools. But women are sexist as well when they treat men like tools. Like, well, you're supposed to take out the garbage, and you're supposed to make a living, and you're supposed to do this, and you're supposed to do that. And because of that, we will have sexism forever and ever, because the flesh gets some very low-grade, deep, intense traction on this, because there is this biological thing that the flesh can exploit. That doesn't make it right. And that doesn't absolve men or women from being sexist. It just is what is. And frankly, I'm actually stunned that there's as many as 40%. 40% of what, I'm asking? I don't know. 40% of households, that's what it was. 40% of households where the woman is the primary wage earner. I'm really stunned that it's that high. Because across the board, I think if you did a survey and you tried to determine between men and women who would rather stay home and take care of the children, you know, I'd really think, and I'm not saying this to be sexist, I'm just saying this because this is what is, I'd really think that you would find that on average, a woman has a greater depth of feeling concerning staying home and taking care of the family than a man does. Because that gets back again to just that biological imperative. So I'm really surprised that it's that high. Now, it might just be 40% because of the economic conditions. And it really doesn't have anything to do with desires, because frankly, I would expect that to be lower if it was just based on the opportunities that are out there and based on the desires of the workers. Because there's a flip side to this. And the flip side is, for me, certainly I think if any woman wants to go out and work in the workforce as the primary breadwinner for a family, more power to her. I'm glad she's doing that. I think she should have the opportunity to do that. But I think really, if you would get women to share their hearts with you, they would say they're not all that, on average, they're not all that interested in doing that. That given a choice, you know, they'd just as soon stay home. So, you know, for those, and perhaps the only reason it's 40%, as I said, because of the work situation and the job market that is now. So I'm not sure that simply quoting statistics about the participation of women in any given area versus the participation of men really accurately indicates sexism. Because in the case of the books, as the author said, what's really happening there is that women just find it silly to have to preen and prance around and act like their book is the greatest book ever. Well, I think some of that can be applied back across a lot of areas. To get to some of these places where we say, see, there's inequity because there isn't as many women as there is men, to get to some of these places requires women to do things that they're just not going to do. And why should they? And I will let you reach your own conclusion as to what I mean when I say, and why should they? This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.